I actually work in Redmond, so my team are all based in Redmond. I work at the .NET Foundation looking after that, but my team in Microsoft is the .NET team. And they are all based in building 25 and building 18 and building 35 in Redmond. So I have to do the whole, you know, remote work thing, which is awesome. So I spend most of my evenings, you know, I don't watch TV anymore, I spend all my evenings on the phone talking to Americans and things. So it's quite nice being here and just being able to talk in my normal speech patterns and my normal cadence of speech, which tends to get quite fast when I'm excited and not have to slow down. Advantage is having an English accent, they all think I'm James Bond, so they naturally assume I'm clever, which is cool. Whereas you guys can hear my northern accent and think I'm an idiot, which is more accurate. The .NET Foundation is the core open source foundation at the heart of .NET, which it's where a lot of the core projects that are part of the modern open source .NET platform are. It's where they call their home. It's deliberately a non-profit, separate organization, completely separate from Microsoft. You know, it's a separate company. I have to do separate tax returns. I have a different board of directors that Miguel Diacaza is on. I have to do, like, you know, I have to file tax returns and things. It's a separate company that I'm actually seconded to by Microsoft. And this is where the heart of open source lives for the .NET platform. Now, one of the goals I set for the .NET Foundation is, so we're here to support an open, commercially friendly, collaborative, open source ecosystem around .NET. An interesting thing about that is we don't want every .NET project to be in the .NET Foundation. That would be a bad thing. I don't know if you've noticed, Microsoft seems to have come to the understanding that monocultures aren't healthy ecosystems anymore, and never have been, really, probably. And you need plenty of diversity to have a healthy ecosystem. And so we explicitly want to encourage open source as a thing around .NET, which is why things like NuGet live in the .NET Foundation and why the investment in NuGet has increased to help drive open source in general. And that's why, you know, things like the F-Sharp Foundation and stuff we're thrilled about and, you know, help and try and support as much as we can. We want a diverse open source ecosystem around .NET, just like there is in some other languages. We need to make sure it's there for .NET as well. And then blah, 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 foundation. Just some cool stats. There's like a lot of, you know, there's over 4,000 to .NET. And when you consider there's only, say, 200-300 on the team in Microsoft, there's a lot of people contributing to .NET that don't work at Microsoft now. So it's cool. And the .NET Foundation itself, it's an open source foundation. You probably don't care what an open source foundation does, but, you know, it provides things like legal support, some governance structures. It provides mentorship for new projects as they're coming in, helping them learn how to do open source, which is, the mentorship is particularly important for projects that have come, say, from Microsoft, and we're trying to help them learn how to be open, how to do things in the open. And then we use Coplex and GitHub as the forges that we support, really. The core where you get all your services from, like source control and work item tracking. But then we provide a bunch of technical services for projects that are in the foundation as well. Just stuff that when you're an open source project maintainer, you don't want to worry about looking after, like SSL certificates. It's, you know, getting them as an individual, you have to pay somebody money and get validation, blah, blah, blah. Whereas when you're a company, it's really easy to do. Similarly, DNS and managing secrets. I look after, I'm a notional contributor on libgit2, which is an open source project I help work on. And we have a libgit2 Twitter account. None of us can remember who set that Twitter account up or what the password is for it. So, and, you know, it's probably somebody who was involved in the project and now has moved on from the project, and we've just no idea. So one of the services we do provide as well is some secret management. So open source projects can share secrets between, you know, people on the team and things and make sure they're kept safe. So just stuff that you need. Now, as you know, we open sourced .NET this time. It was actually at Future Decoded this time last year. My one of my colleagues, Richard Lander, was here, and he announced to you, believe it or not, within seconds of the official announcement going live, you Future Decoded were the first people in the world to hear about it live. So we announced .NET going open source. That's the heart .NET core going open source that day. And, you know, it was fairly big news. We did some other stuff that day, like, I don't know, land a robot on a comet and stuff. You know, it's fairly significant human achievements. And yet Hack and News and Slashdot that day was awesome. It was just like .NET, landed a comet, .NET, landed a comet, .NET. So it was a cool day. And it really marked a sea change in the way that Microsoft, you know, is changing as a company, which is great to see. And I think a lot of developers really like, oh yeah, wow, Microsoft are serious about this open source stuff. This is crazy. So yeah, it's been good. And since then, we've been really busy, and we'll talk about what we've been up to in the past 12 months and what we've got up to now. Microsoft has had a long history in open source, despite what some people think. We've been contributing to Linux for quite a while. You know, some of the contributions to Node and things. We open sourced ASP.NET ages ago. When was that? 2012? Feels like ages ago. And TypeScript, you know, we open source. That's got a big active community working on, like the Angular guys building on top of it and things like that now. So it's pretty, you know, we have been fairly active, but it's true to say that things have really exponentially increased over the past 12 months after we open sourced .NET. And the .NET team have been kind of trailblazing with inside the Microsoft as well, kind of showing them how to do it a bit better. Okay, here's the thing that's worth understanding. .NET is open source is an easy thing to say. But like everything from Microsoft, it's more complicated than the headline. So this is the .NET stack, as you can think about it. And on the top of the .NET stack, you've got all the stuff that you, all the frameworks and things that you tend to code to, like ASP.NET 5 or ASP.NET VNext, as it used to be called until recently. You know, ASP.NET, older version, WinForms, WPF, UWP, you know, for Universal Windows applications. And you can build, for instance, ASP.NET 5, you can build either on top of .NET Core or on top of .NET Framework 4.6. It's supported on top of like both frameworks, if you like. But we tend to think of this as the full desktop framework, and this as .NET Core. Another term we use is standard lib sometimes, but .NET Core is kind of what we think of this part, and this part is, we think of this as the desktop framework. And that pretty clearly shows you, you know, how we came to this point. Back in the day, you know, the .NET framework, it's a big lump of stuff. You know, you put it up, bang, whack it on the machine. It's in the GAC. It's a big lump of stuff. It's cool. There's lots of things there. Awesome for building two-tier client applications. It's amazing. Brilliant. That's what it's designed for. Running servers when you own the servers infrastructure as well, it's really awesome because you own the box. So having one instance of the framework on that box is incredibly efficient. But it is in the GAC, so it's box wide. And once you start going into like container world and having lots of individual versions of .NET, then it starts to break down. And so we saw this coming. Where especially for desktop workloads, .NET Framework 4.6 is awesome. Brilliant. It's designed for that. But for service workloads, so ASP.NET workloads or server-side workloads, really we needed a new version of .NET that was much more modular, much more suitable for running inside of containers. Nuggetized, much more friendly in terms of package managers, so you can just grab the bits that you want. And also, incredibly importantly, it completely cross-platform, built from the ground up, knowing that it wants to be cross-platform. So it compiles on Linux, it compiles on the Mac, you know, there's FreeBSD ports of it. we just announced last week a deal with Red Hat Enterprise Linux, with Red Hat to be able to host Red Hat workloads in Azure, but also for .NET to be a fully supported runtime inside of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And so you can take a .NET container and run it inside, you know, RHEL, and it'd be fully supported. And you pick up the phone call and call Red Hat, and the support engineers for Red Hat are co-located in the same office with the support engineers that know about supporting ASP.NET on Red Hat from Microsoft. So, you know, we mean cross-platform. So we have the framework, and we have .NET Core. And then underneath the framework, there's a bunch of shared components, like the .NET compiler platform, or ROSLIN, as everybody knows it. And I'll keep calling it ROSLIN until it's no longer, you know, until I'm considered old for calling it ROSLIN. But anyway, never mind. We're really good at giving things code names and terrible for giving things real names, but there we are. So the compiler, ROSLIN, is the same compiler across Framework 4.6 and across .NET Core. The just-in-time compiler, the JIT, is the same component. And these are all open source chunks, open source components, which are used across both. But the core framework is a different, you know, is a different version of the .NET framework to the desktop framework. Okay. And then, because of that, and because it's aimed at server workloads, there are some things missing from .NET Core. I mentioned system.drawing isn't in currently isn't in .NET Core because you don't often need that. Actually, it turns out you do use some things like image processing in ASP.NET applications. You actually do need some stuff from here, so we're working on it. But there are chunks that are currently missing still from .NET Core. When you install the .NET framework, if you're a, you know, most of us here, most of you guys, I used to have a real job where I worked at a real company and, you know, did stuff before I came to work at Microsoft. You guys all mostly have real jobs, apart from a couple of you that also work for Microsoft. And when you're in and you're installing .NET, just because a huge swathe of this is now open source, it doesn't change your relationship with Microsoft at the commercial level at all. You still install .NET Framework, for example, is still installed, you know, how you install .NET Framework, Visual Studio or an update or whatever. And it comes under the terms of the Microsoft license agreement your company has signed with Microsoft, you know, the EULA. So you are getting it under the same license terms you always got it and under the same support agreements you always got it when you were installing the distribution from Microsoft. But you can also get we take the open source code, it's developed in the open, and then we package that up and provide a distribution of it, which then is the installed supported distribution, if you know what I mean. That's how it works. So you don't need to go fill out, I'm going to go talk to some banks on Friday, you know, just down the road, and you don't need to go fill out a bunch of extra open source approval paperwork now, because it just so happens that we changed how we build things. You are still getting it under a commercial license, and that's important to remember. Okay. The team are fully open. When we go back a slide, you can get the source code for .NET Framework 4.6. You can go look at the source code, reference source.microsoft.com. It's all there. You can go, you can get most of that code, a fairly large chunk of that code, is actually already available under an open source license as well on GitHub. So in the old way Microsoft used to think about open source, we would kind of squint our eyes and we could pretend that this was open source. But it's not, because we don't take pull requests on this. We don't accept contribution to this. It's incredibly hard to build the .NET framework on your desktop, you know. It uses a bunch of internal Microsoft tooling, blah, blah, blah. It's really hard, like, taking what they call an enlistment, you know, getting all the source code to the .NET framework and building it takes ages. Nobody wants to do that, even the people that work on it inside Microsoft. So that's why we don't consider the .NET framework as a true open source project. .NET Core, the CI builds for .NET Core run on Jenkins. You have access to the CI build servers for .NET Core that the team use. you see on the README page for all the .NET Core projects, you see their current build status at the current check-in. You have 100% transparency. If you see a bug or an issue, and you, I can even say bug properly to you people, and you understand what I'm saying rather than America. This is awesome. Anyway, well, almost hit understand what I'm saying. If you see a bug or an issue or want to fix something, you can see the code that the developers are currently working on. The developers work fully on the GitHub repos that you everybody can see. That's where they work. So there's none of this, do some work over here and publish it. It's there. And so if you go in, you can comment. If you want to get involved in a code review of some language feature, you can get involved in that code review. If you want to go and see how exception filtering was implemented in C# 6, you can see that. If you want to see how the features for C# 7 are coming along, you can see that live and influence that. If you want to be involved in the bleeding edge version, you can. So it's all fully in the open. Actually moving the team fully to open was a significant challenge for us, both in terms of internal engineering system changes, you know, getting our build systems to work against GitHub and things. That's why, I don't know if you noticed, but before we announced open source, about a month before that, Visual Studio Online magically had a feature that seemed a bit random where it could do CI builds from like GitHub, and they were like, well, how did that work? And you know, it's because they needed this to get some of the thing infrastructure running. So we had to do a bunch of stuff to get that to work. We also had to do a load of change management inside the company, a load of training, a load of socializing, they call it, you know, helping people, helping managers who've never worked in open source before understand how open source really works. I remember I was doing, so I helped bring the Git, you know, we have Git support in Visual Studio now, and Team Foundation Server supports Git and things, and that's one of the things I was involved in before I came over to the .NET team. And I remember having a meeting with one of the managers over on the TFS side, and we're talking about a particular feature. Wouldn't it be awesome if Git did X? And they're like, yeah, I need Git to do X. How do I, and Git's open source, how do I make that happen? Like, who do I have a meeting with so I can get that on their backlog, was what he said to me. I was like, whoa, you really don't understand how open source works, do you? It's more like, which engineer am I going to give to this problem so I can contribute a pull request and spend the time talking to the community explaining why this is a good idea? You know, that's what you want to be asking, not how do I have a meeting about this? You know? Which has been good. It's driven some healthy changes inside the company. Less meetings and more code. Awesome. So we accept contributions, but all the old contribution channels are still there, obviously. We vigorously listen to user voice. We respond to connect quite often now. When we respond to connect, it's, yeah, awesome feedback. Here is the GitHub issue I raised to track this connect issue. And then somebody will come back a bit later to your connect issue saying, oh, hey, just wanted to let you know, here's the pull request where I'm actually contributing a code fix to solve your bug. I think this fixes your bug. What do you think? And because the .NET team, they're the luckiest team in the world. We get to talk to like people usually smarter than us. You know, we get to talk to other developers. That they can go and look at the pull request and go, you know what? That isn't actually what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. And can actually comment on what we're doing. And for a team like the .NET team, that's huge in terms of agility, in terms of reducing the time to ship and being able to increase the feedback loop. If you're a framework team like .NET, it's insanely hard to try and get people to run the latest version of your framework to give you feedback. Who here is building applications on framework 4.6 right now? Exactly. Okay, 3.4. Who's building? So let's go down. Right, who's on 4.5, one of the versions of 4.5? Oh, okay, awesome. You're obviously cutting edge, interesting people, that's why. And then who's on, like, I don't know, 2. Anyone got any 2 stuff they're supporting? Who's doing any Unity stuff? Then you're definitely doing 2. You know what I mean? So there's, when you go into, like, again, you're cool because you're here. When you go into normal customers and we go talk to them, you know, hands keep going up all the way down the stack. It's really hard getting people to use the latest framework versions. And so by going open source, the amount of feedback we can get live on stuff we're doing is huge. And it means that when we actually ship that feature or that stuff in a box somewhere, in a Microsoft supported distribution, it's already had so much more feedback and so much more live usage than it ever used to have. And so the quality just goes up enormously. Anyway. So that kind of feeds into the different ways in which when Microsoft as a company uses open source. I broke it down in sort of three categories. There's a fourth, which I'll talk about. But you have collaboration, where it's a thing that we are deliberately putting out into the open source community to share ownership of it. We recognize that this is a thing that's so important to Microsoft strategically, but also so important to lots of other businesses that we want to make it a shared component. It's kind of a gift. We're ceding some control over something to enable other people to be jointly invested in it. So .NET's probably the best example of that, but also things like TypeScript are really good examples. F# is a brilliant example that's kind of in .NET. And then we have a bunch of integrations where we work with the people who are really invested in that open source ecosystem and making sure we can make money from it, if you like, you know, making sure we work well with it. So things like Cordova or Docker, you know, making sure we have really good Docker support is really important to us. Now, Docker is an open source project, so we can actually put Microsoft people on making Docker work really well in Azure and making, you know, Windows work really well with Docker and things. We can do that by contributing people and enabling integration scenarios where previously we might have had to do special commercial agreements or we might have had to stuff. Now we can just actually throw people at it and make it happen, which is brilliant. The next one is interoperability. So this is where we're like talking to a system that we don't, you know, but it's different. Now this is where Git started. Git started over in the interop space because we wanted to be able to talk to Git. We wanted Xcode to be able to talk to Visual Studio Online, things like that. We wanted Visual Studio to be able to talk to GitHub. It was an integration scenario. But it's actually quickly become, through integration into collaboration, we now have a significant number of the core Git contributors now work for Microsoft. And it's... We have about three version control systems that are used inside the company. TFVC is the main one, so Team Foundation Version Control, like centralized version control. And then Git is probably now number two, and then we have some legacy ones in the company. So Microsoft, in its own internal engineering, is now critically dependent on Git. And so that's why we've invested a lot more in it. And so now it's moved up the tree, and now it's really something we collaborate on. It's a project which Microsoft like kind of jointly own with the community the destiny of Git just because of our levels of contribution to it. The fourth one, which I don't really call out because it's kind of old school Microsoft, well, it is and isn't. There's a bunch of services that we make like SDKs and things available as open source. We don't do that because we expect you to spend a bunch of time fixing a bug on Azure Storage SDK, whatever. That's, you know, why are you motivated to fix that? You can if you want, but we recognize that we spend most of the time investing in that. The reason why it's open source is it increases the ability for you to use it. So it increases the ability for you to include it with another application, be it open source or not, and it increases the ability for us to be able to distribute it to everything, you know, to lots of different Linux platforms and blah, blah, blah. By open sourcing it, we increase our breadth of distribution. So that's the other case where we typically do open source today. But it's not really true open source because you're not really worried about contribution. So again, Microsoft's got really different the way it thinks about open source. When something is open source, it's not just when it's under an open source license. We think it's when we take contribution. It's when we take pull requests. That's when we really think it's proper open source. The goal behind .NET being open source was to enable everybody to take a joint share. We want to make it so that other cloud vendors are really confident in building .NET support into their cloud stack. We want to make it so that other people who are looking at embedding .NET are really confident about betting on it as a platform, and so that you as .NET developers are secure in your investment in .NET, because you're not just able to deploy stuff to the Microsoft stack, but to lots of other people's stacks. And that's good for everybody. It's good for our customers, it's good for Microsoft. So, but another key reason was also to make sure we could enable the cross-platform scenarios. Mostly because like a lot of these communities expect that. To integrate with Linux, you need to integrate with a lot of open source stuff anyway, so why not? It's easier if you're open source. But also, just like getting help on this stuff is amazing. We announced this time last year, we announced open source, you know, .NET Core going open source, the heart of .NET being open source. By the end of the following week, 4 days later, Jeff Norton, who used to work on the Mono, do a lot of work with Mono, still does a lot of work with Mono, he had contributed Mac OS X support a week after, like 4 days. I was like, well, now, we were going to work on that. Don't get me wrong. That's something that we had intended to go look at, like, you know, after a few months. He just turned around and did it, like, over a weekend, a long weekend, like, because it was Thanksgiving weekend, that's right. I was like, dude, that's amazing. So it's occasionally, like, magic stuff like that happens. A team assembled, the FreeBSD port team, a virtual team of people who care about FreeBSD. That's not a platform we particularly cared about supporting. It was, you know, we mostly care about Linux and Windows for deployment scenarios and Mac and Windows for development scenarios. But yeah, FreeBSD came along. Yeah, let's have FreeBSD support. Boom, working. Whoa, that's amazing. You know, so all these things happen, which is cool. And obviously the Xamarin side. So now I want to talk a little bit about the journey .NET has made. Before I do that, it's worth recapping the journey that C# has made as a .NET language. So I started back in the sort of C# 1 world, generics world. Anything after generics, I went and did a lot of Eclipse stuff during this time frame here. So I was in the Java world for a little bit there, believe it or not. Still working for Microsoft, but you know. So anything after generics is still a bit new to me. Like I'm still, you know, Link, I still haven't quite got the hang of that syntax, believe it or not. And then you've got the whole async await stuff, you know. Whoa, it's still, you know, I can just about do it, but I still have to think about it every time I use it. So, and modern .NET is just an amazing language. You look at some C# 6 and how condensed it is and how it's, you know, how expressive it is as a language. It's such a completely different language to, you know, C# 2, where it was still quite a verbose language. It's come on loads. The major thing in C# 6, there were some language features I'll cover just quickly. If you wanted to know more about this, you're probably in the wrong room. It's like 11 is the minute Mads is talking about that, so sorry. Go watch the video. But yeah, C# 6, there are some new features. The main real feature was a platform feature, was Roslyn, the compiler platform. And the Roslyn is totally open source, completely open, and it's a proper open source project everybody can get involved with. And it enables us to have a lot of the cool new IDE experiences, but it also enables us to add new features a lot easier because it's written in C#. It's not just a, like 10,000 lines of C++, which the compiler used to be, you know what I mean, in one file. It actually has an architecture now. It says beautiful architecture because Mads wrote this slide, but it has an architecture, let's say. It definitely has an architecture, and it is pretty good. Like TypeScript, we did Roslyn, and then Anders went and did TypeScript, and a lot of the learnings from Roslyn went into TypeScript as well in terms of architectures and things. The two are quite similar. And yeah, it's really cool as a compiler and enables us to do a lot of compiler as a service stuff. But being fully open, it also allows us to do some cool things like the OmniShot team getting involved and hooking into Roslyn and then being able to have deep IntelliSense and code completion within like Sublime Text or Visual Studio Code, you know, over on the Mac and things. It opens up a whole new set of scenarios that we never could do before when we had a big chunk of C++ that only worked on Windows and only like two people in the world could actually read. Just to recap some of the features in C# 6, I can demo some of these if you really want to talk at the end, or just come down to the Visual Studio booth in the expo hall. Me and Mads and Dustin will be hanging out there this afternoon, so feel free to come on down there. But some of the cool things for me, Things like the, you know, the auto property initializers make it a lot more, you know, so you can just do get set kind of thing for your properties. The getter only properties saved a lot of code. Using static, I've never really got that. So you can do things like using static date time dot whatever, you know, whatever the day of the week thing, and then you can just like use day of week in your code. So you can do some really like nasty stuff to your, you know, you can make some really unreadable code if you want to. But hey, it's awesome. Exception filters was a feature I used to do a lot of VB back in the day, and like VB's had exception filters for ages. So that's, you know, catch this exception if such a condition is true. That's in C# now, and you can actually go look at the source code in Roslyn that implements that feature. And it's a feature that's been in IL. It's been a feature that's been in .NET, the CLR, forever. But the C# language never enabled it before. But now that Roslyn, the compiler, is the same shared compiler between C# and VB.NET, you know, it makes it really easy to add those sorts of features into C# now. So that's there. And if anyone has got the hang of the await, you know, async stuff, then actually being able to, and has an API they talk to that's async, then being able to use an await in a catch and a, you know, in a finally, it is really helpful. Coming to when we're looking forward to .NET 7, there's a bunch of trends that we're tracking, mostly again around cloud workload scenarios. So, you know, networking performance, how things are serialized over the wire, blah blah blah. All that stuff is what we're really thinking of. And if you want to follow in real time of what the conversations are happening as to what is going on in C#, you can do that now because it's fully open. So let's talk about the .NET journey. Now, going open, you know, it's one small step for a normal software company. You know, it was one giant leap for Microsoft. There was definitely a leap of faith moment in there where we had to jump. So we started off kind of just making the source open. The source to .NET's been open forever over at reference. It's been available forever over at reference.source.microsoft.com. But then we actually made the source for the Roslyn project, which we're talking about here. We made it open. That was November 2014, I think. I'm trying to remember. That was a build. No, it'd be March 2014. I remember being backstage with Dustin, who's here this week, and Anders was ahead of stage pressing the publish button, and me and Dustin were backstage, like, biting our nails, you know, making sure it was all going to work. We put the compiler open. Like, Microsoft invested a lot of money in that compiler. That was a big deal for us to do. We made it open. It was available as open source, but we weren't really, it was quite hard to submit pull requests to. It was really hard to run tests because a lot of the tests for it still relied on internal Microsoft tooling. There was no CI build server for it, so you didn't know if it was building or not yet. You know, it wasn't fully open. It was just the source was out there. And what actually happened is the team worked on a Team Foundation version control repository inside Microsoft. It was TFVC back then. It wasn't even, and it was inside the server. It was inside the firewall as well. It wasn't even on Visual Studio Online back then. And then you would see big commits come into the Git repository of bring a big lump of code into the repository from a fork maintained over here. So it wasn't truly, we weren't working in the open yet. At that time, we then also opened the design notes. So we made the how the language is going, we made those available to the community so the community could give us feedback on. And we made them available in the wiki initially, and then we've moved to making them available in issues, and now they're available as pull requests. And then we made the source open. We accepted some limited contributions. We actually took some pull requests. But the big leap for us was when we actually moved the engineers to GitHub, working in the same repo that everybody else sees. That was the biggest jump for us, and that was also where we saw the complete exponential growth in terms of community engagement, because everybody could follow in real time what the engineers were actually doing and why, and join in the discussions. And then we find after that point, you've got to do a bunch of stuff improving your documentation, because now we're actually all there out in the open. There's a bunch of tribal knowledge. You need to make sure that that's all written down and shared across the whole team as well. And then finally, you've got to share some ownership. You've got to actually invite people in and, you know, go from just having full-time engineers in Microsoft working on the code to people, so everybody can send pull requests in, but actually having somebody who doesn't work for Microsoft having the ability to merge code into that repository. And that's a huge step, which not all projects have got to yet. Some have, some haven't. But the increase in community engagement we saw was just massive. You know, we went from, like I say, accepting a pull request a month to like 8 pull requests a month, which is what we're currently taking on average. And the number of issues is huge, and that causes some pains as well, because there's quite a high signal to noise ratio. There's no good all those issues sitting there if you don't triage them and give feedback on them. So, you know, you've got to make sure you're responsive to the community, which keeps everybody busy. And people go off and do the work. One of the things that we do track to make sure we're being responsive, Microsoft's incredibly, like Mr. Guthrie was downstairs this morning. You go into a meeting with Scott, you need metrics. You know, there's no good coming to him with hunches. You need to show Scott the data as to why he should invest in something. And I work for Scott via several levels of management. You know, he's like my boss's boss, or something like that. So one of the things we track a lot of is data. And here's some data I pulled off the server last week. And it's basically, we respond to a pull request we respond to within an hour, 75%. And we're always trying to drive that higher. And that's pretty good. And that's like a real response. That's not a robot, you know, saying, you know, thank you, your pull request is important to us, please hold, sort of thing. It's actual, a human has looked at it and gone, oh, wow, okay. Yeah, or you know what? We're not going to do this. Like, this is a crazy feature. You want to add support for French quotes as string literals? No, I'm not going to do that. I like double quotes, thanks. Or you know, curly word style quotes? No, we're going to have just double quotes. Or like date. I'll probably insult somebody now who's in the audience. But yeah, like get. If this is your feature, I apologize. But like with date time. Maybe instead of date time, do the literals, .monday and things. Wouldn't it be awesome if I could use my own language in that? So I could do, you know, my French is terrible, mercredi or whatever, or, you know, whatever the local language is. That feels like it would be awesome to the person contributing to the feature. But then when our language designers look at it and they go, you know what, see, what you're telling me is you would like to write code that doesn't compile if you have a locale setting on a different machine? Probably not, you know? Probably that's not a feature we're gonna have. We're gonna stick to what we've got, and this is why. You need to give that feedback instantly so people, if somebody submitted a pull request, they care passionately about something. So you have to, you wanna respond to them as to why that's a good idea or not, how they can get this into something you will accept. And then, we aim to close PRs as rapidly as we can, again, giving them the feedback if, yes, this is going to come in with a bit of tweaks, or no, this is crazy. You know, you need to give that feedback as quick as we can. As you know, issues are a long way behind pull requests, and we kind of need to get those higher. That's something we're investing in a lot of time on. A lot of that is due to the signal-to-noise ratio, because it's so much easier to raise an issue than it is to submit some code that fixes something. But we're getting there, we're getting better. Here's another set of metrics we track, which was how are we doing at accepting, getting contribution compared with other things like Mono and, you know, how Roslyn did, and then how CoreCLR and CoreFX is doing compared with competition, you know, like Node or whatever. You know, these are important things we track to make sure we are, how are we doing? How is our community? Is it healthy? Maybe make that one a bit bigger. Hang on a second. So this is another one I look at, langpop.net. Yeah, this is similar to like the Redmonk language survey is like a, but basically it's how much code got checked in C# to GitHub in the past month, how much code came, and how many Stack Overflow questions and answers were asked. You know, and this really helps us understand what's going on. One of the things we do is we always try and balance metrics by having things, you know. Turns out you might get a lot of Stack Overflow questions, but yet nobody's checking in code in the real world. Like, well, why is that? Well, maybe it's because your language is terrible and really hard to learn, so people need to go to Stack Overflow all the time. Or maybe you have the opposite response in a meeting. You know, your Stack Overflow rates are really low. Well, we're awesome. Our language is brilliant. Everybody can understand it. You know what I mean? So you need to back up. You can't have. There's no good having one-dimensional metrics at anything. Again, sorry. That's something we always get. You know, if you're going into a meeting with a one-dimensional metric, again, you'll get ripped to shreds. You have to have things that balance each other out. So we have several tensions as we're developing open source. The first one is maintaining a product direction. Now, .NET doesn't just belong to, you know, my team in Redmond. It belongs to the community. It belongs to the whole virtual .NET team. How do we set the direction? That's a hard thing to do. So some of the things we've done is we put the, I mentioned the design notes for the C# language. We take the notes from the design meetings, and we first of all put them as issues onto GitHub so people could comment on them. It's how we did a wiki first, and then we did this. When we did it as issues, it was great. We got a lot of engagement, but you'll notice we got like 250 comments from 100 different people. Opinions are cheap, you know? Talking is cheap. It's like, unless somebody's really engaged and got skin in the game, you can get a high signal-to-noise rate, you know, a bad signal-to-noise ratio. And so we needed to experiment, because actually there was buried in the 250 comments, there was some amazingly good feedback, and there was a lot of stuff that's just, you know, well, that's your opinion, you know, I don't know. I prefer new lines after a curly brace, you know, you prefer not to have that. And that argument can go on forever. Somebody makes a decision, this is the way we want it, and that's fine. You know, so you do need to have something. So we went from issues to now we actually put them on the, we commit them into the repository, and we use a pull request to do that. So people can comment on the pull request, but it's visible, and you can actually go in and adjust how you do that. And then we also have the tension between, there's people that we're paying to contribute to something, and then there is the people who are doing it, you know, because it's at the weekend and it's something that they love. And so the people that we're paying to do it, they have deadlines, you know, and they need to ship something tonight, whereas the other people, they're just doing it because it's something that they're passionate about. And so occasionally you'll have a feature where it's like, hey, I really need this to get in. And another person saying, but yeah, you've just hacked that in. I want it to be done properly and follow such and such a pattern or whatever. That's attention. We find it actually improves code quality enormously because everyone's inspecting every single commit we're doing. So, you know, people raise the game, but also it adds additional tension into there that we have to kind of manage. But as I mentioned earlier, the community are awesome. They added Mac OS 10 support. We had another problem where we had a great test suite for Link that we hadn't spent the time to port yet, and we just said, hey, by the way, this exists. And then we were gonna come back to it, and somebody just saw that it existed and came and ported it for us, like, within a few hours. It was amazing, so. And then the final eternal problem is when you go open source, you are also becoming a distributed team. And I can tell you, I can spend a whole hour talking to you about the joys and pains of working in a distributed team, because I've done it for 10 years now. You have to commit to the fact you're doing that. So you have to learn how to communicate asynchronously. You have to learn how to make sure you share your tribal knowledge in written forms. But you also have to make effort to do stuff that's be more disciplined and, you know, organize events like this or organize meetups where the community get together and can kind of have those high bandwidth, you know, interactions, just like you do when in a company where you organize offsites, so you go visit the different teams and so on. You need to do that with open source projects as well. And then finally, we'll just recap with some of the stuff we do when we're fostering community. This was the advice from a lot of the people on the team. The important thing is to just, you know, be cool, be classy, don't be a jerk. So when you're responding to feedback, this is somebody's baby they've invested a lot of time on. Make sure you give feedback to that. Make sure you have fun. We do a lot of fun in the team. Make sure you share that fun. So I don't know if you know, people who did their first contribution to .NET, we bought a bunch of mugs when their contributions came in. So this is a cup of tea. Ha-ha, hilarious English joke. And we actually went and laser etched the commit ID into it and stuck in their ID and things like that. So that was awesome. Is it, and we also, this is the video for the Kinect thing. There's a little Easter egg in there, like Scott Guthrie is coming, I'll show that again. And he's got his cup of tea. So we try and sneak those things into the video so that the people who actually do have those cups of tea go, oh, wow, Guthrie's got one of the same cups I've got, and, you know, just stuff like that. You've got to have fun. And then the brilliant thing is seeing how the culture's changed in Microsoft. I created the GitHub org for Microsoft, the official one, back in June last year. We've now got 2,000 engineers working full-time in GitHub. That's crazy. You know, it's just grown so much. We've got 2,000 open source projects, but we have 12,650 people who've contributed to one of those projects. So a lot of people are able to come in and join us and help shape the future of Microsoft. It really helps when you have a CEO that's actively supporting you in this. So obviously Satya's been driving a lot of this change. But the thing that I've been thrilled with most, actually, is seeing the change in the culture of the team. This was... you send out, when people have babies and things, they'll send out a picture of the baby they've just had and going to go off on holiday for a few months, you know, whatever. It was hilarious because the response to it was, looks good to merge, you know, plus one, merge it, sort of thing. So I just enjoy the way seeing the engineering culture in Microsoft change over the past 12 months even. It's just been amazing to watch and to experience and been a very exciting time to be in the company. How would you get involved? Go check out our repos. Go read along with the language design notes, and more importantly, start your own open source .NET project. If you don't already have one today, then go start one if you can, if your company allows. If your company doesn't allow, then make sure you can try and see how you can contribute, you know, can at least consume some open source and speed up your time to development. Okay, that's everything. People have got questions, let me know. And then I say I'll be down in the booth, the Visual Studio booth, for the rest of the afternoon. And don't forget at 4:40, the Professor Brian Cox will be in the afternoon keynote, and you know, he's the only sort of particle physicist who used to be in a boy band, so talking about quantum computing. So he's a beautiful chap who I've got a bit of a man crush on, so join me and watch that keynote. And then there'll be some drinks after that over in the expo hall as well, so feel free to join us then. Thank you very much for your time, thanks for coming, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.